Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Now, you all know that I get along with pretty much everyone, and I just so delight in meeting other people and finding out their stories, getting to know them. I mean, partially, this podcast is an excuse to meet other human beings in the world who are putting beauty out there, who are creating good things for other people, and who are making this world a more magical place. And this week, I was so lucky to have a conversation with Gretchen Menn. And, you know, every once in a while, I just meet someone and it's like, holy cow, I could talk to you for hours. You are the best. I wish we were neighbors. I'd be over all the time borrowing butter or whatever. And Gretchen was exactly this person. She's pretty phenomenal and incredibly talented and funny, as you'll hear. And she also has a Wikipedia. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the Wikipedia because already I know they would do a lot better job of telling who Gretchen is. So Gretchen is an American guitarist and composer who has her own original instrumental work and is also the lead guitarist for Zeppelin, an all-female-led Zeppelin tribute band. She was included in Guitar Player Magazine's 50 Sensational Female Guitarists and Guitar Player Magazine's 50 Years of Extraordinary Players. I mean, there's so much about Gretchen, and I watched a few of her YouTube videos that show her playing the guitar, and I just was like, oh my God, she is so ridiculously good. When you see someone that is that good, that adept at creating beauty, at bringing gorgeousness out into the world, you just have to step back and bow down. And that's basically kind of how I felt during the entire interview with Gretchen. So now let's get into it, because I cannot wait for you to meet Gretchen and hopefully laugh along with us.
It was the middle of the day. It was I was going to walk downtown with one of my good friends, and I ran upstairs to grab my shoes and we were going to walk downtown. And I hear this like dragging noise. Let me see if I can this kind of noise. And I look over, and on my desk, the padlock that I kept for my gym locker, I saw it move across the desk, just, and then it tossed itself like halfway across the room.
If you had to go to, you know, a party, let's say, you know, very few people, and you're standing in front of people and you have to tell them who you are. And then the other question I always ask, or if you're on stage, which is so appropriate for you because you are on stage a lot of the time and you have to tell people maybe at a conference who you are, how would you do that?
I guess the quickest way, and maybe it's not, you know, obviously there's so much more we could say. It's like, sometimes you got to either describe yourself in like less than 5 words, or you need like, you know, an autobiography. What I have in my Instagram bio is, you know, guitarist, composer, kitty mom, eternal student of music, book nerd.
I love that. Do you have a book club? I must know.
Ooh, I don't, but I'm always trying to get people. Like, what I do have is a number of friends, Clementine's one of them, where we talk a lot about things, and where their recommendations or their gifts are always kind of top of my book read. Like right now I'm reading, I always have a few things going. Hard Rain Falling was given to me by Angela Petrilli, who's a dear friend of mine, also a great guitar player. And somebody, if you would like to chat with her, she's a great conversationalist too.
I love great conversationalists. So thank you. I'll probably take you up on that. You know, I was reading your bio on your website, and I really got the feeling that music captured you so early, and that even though you had a little, you know, little diversion
to the side where you went to flight school, that there really was no other choice. Would I be wrong about that?
No, definitely not wrong about it. I would say I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a musician. Like I went to college as an undeclared major. I knew I loved English. I loved sociology, but I'm also, I mean, I am a for real nerd. Like I remember being a kid and like people asking me what my favorite subject was in school and I couldn't choose because I loved them all. You know, it wasn't until later that I was like, you know, math is kind of, you know, getting to be a little bit of a drag. But even all through elementary school, I loved math. I loved science. I loved all of it. So I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do because I was so interested in so many different things. And when I went to college, I kind of thought maybe I would be like an English or a sociology major, but it wasn't until I got to college where I realized or where I found out that because in high school I had taken some advanced placement classes, that those actually counted for college credit. And so when I got to college, they were like, hey, do you know you've got like a full year's worth of credits? Like essentially you could be a second semester sophomore right now. And I had like just gotten there. And so I was like, well, yeah, like sign me up for a year less debt, you know, because, you know, even though I had a little bit of financial aid and stuff, it's like I knew that I was getting myself into debt and I was going to be paying it off. So I was like, yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. Graduate a year early. But then you learn so much about yourself when you have to make a huge decision kind of in the blink of an eye. And it was that as much as I tend to be somebody who's very deliberate and I'm not indecisive, but I think I tend to really think things through and then, you know, careful consideration. And then I make a decision. I think of myself from a place of logic. And in that moment, it was really from the heart, which is I just thought I'm an undergraduate. It doesn't matter. Even if I wanted to be a doctor, it doesn't really matter what I study right now. I'm going to study what I'm most genuinely interested in learning more about, and that's music. So I declared a music major.
And, you know, my listeners don't know, but music runs in your family.
A bit, yeah. Writing more so. Writing is like, I feel like everybody I'm related to is somehow a writer of some sort practically. But my dad, when I was growing up, was a writer. And I didn't like think that deeply about it. I mean, I don't know how many kids really are deeply aware of what their parents actually do. But for me, I'm like, oh, my dad's a writer. He works at a magazine. When is he coming home so we can hang out? You know, that was my real question. And it wasn't until like high school where I got interested in like, you know, music and guitar oriented music that my dad's like, hi, do you know that I worked for Guitar Player magazine? And at this point he had moved on. So he wasn't there anymore, but it was more like that when I developed an interest, he was like, a wealth of information. And I remember him taking me to Tower Records and we went CD shopping and I got like a whole stack. He's like, okay, if you like Joe Satriani and Steve Vai, you should know who like Eric Johnson and, you know, Steve Morse and Django Reinhardt. And, you know, so it was more like, he never pushed me into that. And that's something that I'm always, anytime I ever like see something that mentions him, I always feel like, I want to make it really clear, like, I didn't have stage parents at all. My dad's affiliation with guitar, he never even suggested that I should take up guitar. It was more like, once I said I wanted to, he was like, I've got a guitar sitting around here. Go ahead. You know, you can use that for your first lesson. So he was certainly very supportive, but it was never like, hey, you should probably do this. I feel like both my parents were, they saw the value of music. And I remember from a really early age, like pretty much any musical instrument that we wanted to rent from the local like music store, they would just rent us whatever. Like I think we could only have one at a time in addition to our primary instrument. And my primary instrument when I was a kid was like flute. And so I remember like also wanting, so I think we purchased it. I still have my flute. It's like under here. You know, so it's like I could try out a clarinet for a month and then like buy me a book that would show the different fingerings. And I had a trumpet for a little bit and we had a harp for a while that was way less angelic to play than I imagined. It was like big and bulky. And my sister and I were just like, I don't know about this. So they were, both of my parents were really supportive of the arts in general. And my mom, just as much as my dad, while my dad, like, you know, was the one taking me to the, you know, to get CDs, my mom was the one who, from an early age, was always taking us to theater. So we saw, you know, plays, musicals, operas, ballets, you know. So I felt like music was always something that was kind of around and revered, even though nobody in my immediate family is a professional musician. A lot of them are kind of are very musical. My sister is a doctor and is insanely talented. She's trained in opera. She plays piano. She plays violin. Yeah, she's insanely talented, but she's made it her mission to save lives. So she's a radiologist, but I always write her parts for my albums. So I keep her singing at least a little bit.
Oh my gosh. She's a trained opera singer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, she hasn't performed professionally, but she has a gorgeous voice and she certainly studied very seriously.
Okay. I am intrigued. As a kid, did you find the different instruments, were some of them more challenging than others? Or did you feel like they all kind of had the same level of difficulty when you were beginning to learn them?
Well, let's see. I can't say that I didn't spend much time with, like, guitar is my first stringed instrument. So there was quite a crossover between, like, flute and clarinet. I remember even a lot of the fingerings on the clarinet were the same or really similar to flute. So I remember picking that up and being like, oh, this is, like, you know, I felt like I had a head start for sure on that. And then trumpet, I remember just, you know, it has the three vowels. And so I was like, oh, okay, you know, but those are all wind instruments, right? So it's not like I went and had to deal with, like, the horrors of sounding awful on a violin. Although I have picked up my sister's violin, and I can just say, I think it's one of those instruments that until you're really good, you sound really bad. I mean, it's a beast of an instrument. I always apologize to true string players when they come to a Zeppelin show and watch me abuse a Les Paul with a violin bow.
I actually wanted to ask you about that because there is a picture on your website of you using a bow on a guitar like that. And I am so curious because honestly, I mean, most of my life, I've seen people play guitar the regular way. Mm-hmm. You hold it, use your fingers. That, I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anyone use a bow with a guitar. So how did you start? What made you start?
I can take no credit for this. This is 100% Jimmy Page. And I don't think he was the first to do it. He was certainly, as far as everybody who's, like, you know, a guitar player, if you were to be like, who's the first person, like your Jeopardy question, who is the first person who, you know, played a Les Paul with a violin bow? Okay, you know. But it was a hymn thing. And so when, you know, in the song Dazed and Confused, well, there's two, Dazed and Confused, How Many More Times? There may have been others, but in terms of, like, Zeppelin catalog, those are, like, the two, with Dazed and Confused being, like, a huge hit, a really iconic Led Zeppelin song, and it's got this violin, like, this Les Paul with a violin bow in the solo section. And I didn't want to do it at first, because when Clementine said she wanted to do this whole, you know, paying homage to the music of Led Zeppelin, I really wanted to do it because I loved the music. And I know that as a guitar player, Jimmy is so, he has such a huge spectrum of stuff that, and I knew it was going to be like the best education because I was brand new. I was utterly unqualified to be a guitar player for, like, pretty much anybody. But Clementine knew that I had the discipline. And so she took a chance on me. And when she said, we need to do Dazed and Confused, I was like, you know, one of the whole things that we agreed about with Zeppelin was that we weren't going to do anything that might make a mockery or make it seem like we were you know, some bands lend themselves to, you know, like if you're going to be in a Kiss tribute, obviously you got to do all the stuff. That's how Kiss is. Zeppelin was less about that kind of showiness. They were very kind of musically kind of purist in the way that they delivered their music. And I'm like, I don't want to do anything where we're like mimicking them or, you know, I'm not going to, I don't know. I think let's be really super respectful. Let's treat this music like we're a string quartet playing a piece of Beethoven. Let's treat it like let's do it properly, but let's not, I don't know, like mimic the gestures or whatever. And so I was a little worried that the violin bow would come across as kind of Spinal Tap, like that it would just be too much like shtick. And so I was really hesitant, and Clem can tell you, it's not, you know, I don't have a hard time arguing my case. Like if I really feel strongly about something, I will. It's not to say that I'm unable to hear other points of view. I am, but it's like, you know, you don't have to worry about swaying me too much. And so I made a whole case of why I thought that was a bad idea and why I don't think we should do it and blah, 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 blah. And Clementine is the most benevolent band leader. And I don't even remember how she convinced me, but essentially it became clear that this was going to happen whether or not I liked it. And so I kind of like had to roll up my sleeves, got a violin bow, looked at my guitar and was like, okay, like, huh? You know, cause it isn't like you just go and we were doing this before, like you could find anything on YouTube, you know. Sometimes it's easy to forget how recent the wealth of information everywhere is. But it's like I had to figure it out. I had to go get some rosin. I had to do a lot of trial and error. And it wasn't until I started sort of seeing how much audiences appreciated it and started enjoying the sounds you could get from it that I stopped feeling embarrassed to do it. And now I really enjoy it.
Wow. Well, in the image, you make it look easy. I'm like, yeah, seriously. Well, I have to let you know that I am terrified of flying and I hate airplanes for lots of different reasons.
Okay.
I think claustrophobia is one. Another reason is I don't like being that close to people I don't know, you know, and so you're sitting. Anyway, so when I read on your bio that you chose...
voluntarily.
Yes. I was thinking of myself at that age and trying to envision, like, would I make this choice? Would I, because back then I wasn't as scared of flying, but I was like, would I have made this? No. So how did this happen?
Right. Okay. A few things happened. So first, I worked jobs in retail and at a bar during my summers between, you know, in college. And all I can say is I have nothing but the most profound respect for people who can work just kind of service industry jobs. And like, it's so hard. The work is so hard. The pay is so bad. And I kind of came back to school after a summer of working part-time in retail and then like a night job, like at a bar. I wasn't old enough to serve drinks, but I was like the person who, like, if you wanted to play pool, like you had to come up and, you know, charge people for that. So, it was a terrible summer for practice. I realized that, you know, that I was super disconnected from my guitar, and I've always been a very dedicated practicer. And I just thought, you know, I got into music with no delusions of how bad of a financial decision it would be. And I had seen enough musicians who were very, very good musicians develop a terrible attitude about the industry because it's really hard to make money doing music. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to do this, I should just accept that it's going to be a bad way to make money. And that way I can keep loving music. Because what ends up happening if you don't accept that reality, unless you're insanely lucky with all the stars aligning and all of that, that it's a terrible financial decision. And it induces artists to take gigs for the paycheck. And then ultimately they end up hating what they're doing. And I thought, you know, I am so lucky to have something I love so much. Not everybody gets that, you know? And if I'm going to do this, how do I protect my love of music, like, at all costs? And I thought, all right, I just have to expect it to make me no money whatsoever. And I'm just going to pursue it for the absolute love of it. And my goal is going to be to become as fluent as possible in the language that I most love. And in terms of how do I pay the rent, I'll find another way to do it. And at that point, I knew it wasn't going to be like retail or customer service type stuff, because I didn't come home able, like, I was so spent, I didn't have the time to be able to practice well. So I thought, okay, what can I do that will be like a compatible career? And in college, I had taken a couple of flight lessons very capriciously. It was like a discount available for students at the college. So I went for like a few lessons and I'm like, well, this is fun. Also, I'm a college student who has student loans. Guess what? I don't have like money for an expensive hobby. So I was like, okay, well, this isn't going to happen. But then when I was looking at graduating, I thought, oh, wait a minute. I know how much my flight instructor makes. What does it cost to go to flight school? And I found out that a year of flight school, if you worked hard, was about the same price as a year of college. And I was like, oh, so I've already sort of mentally budgeted 4 years of time and 4 years of tuition. If I can still get to the end of that at the same deadline with the same amount of money spent, and now I have a music degree and all of these flight credentials, I'll be able to flight instruct, pay off my debt, do something that's at least interesting. Because when you're flight instructing, like, you're either helping people achieve a goal, work towards a dream, or in some cases, overcome a fear. And there's something really fun about doing that. There's greater challenges. No two students are the same. No two flights are the same. And it engages your brain in a way that when I would come home, I would still be excited to pick up my guitar. So I did it as totally my responsible plan B. So
I am bowing down to you right now because I mean, I think what I'm really excited by is you have this innate sense of curiosity that's what I'm kind of gathering. And then you said, I'm a nerd. So for me, that those are people who like to learn and they're captivated by the world. They like to, what is new? What don't I know yet? And also I feel like a lot of times people like that don't give up. You know, if there's something new to learn, if it becomes challenging, they just move through it versus giving up and walking away. And, flight school, I have thought about it. I've considered it because I have been told it is an excellent way to get over your fear of flying. But also, it's not at the top of my list. So I'm going to table that for a while. But I just want to, just the idea of you, you know, knowing, because I have worked in customer service jobs.
My God, it's horrible.
It is. It's exhausting. When you come home, sometimes you're just it's all you can do to crawl to bed and just like go to sleep because.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you're thinking of like, when you're working at a bar, it's like, you're looking forward to the creepy older guys who flirt with you because they're like less of a pain than the angry people. You know what I mean? Like, so even like the good customers are sometimes ones that like, even now you think, God, what a bummer that I had to deal with that when I was like 19, you know, but like, hey, at least they weren't, you know, yelling at me because, you know, I couldn't get them a beer, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there was this period of time I lived in Bellingham, Washington, and it was winter. So as you can imagine, the days were short. I mean, the light was short because the days were short. And I worked at a bar. We'd close it too. And then, you know, you have to clean up and you have to do all of that stuff. So, and then not only that, I don't know if you had this problem because you were working, I'd be so keyed up that I wouldn't be able to go to sleep till like right. 5 or 6.
Right.
So I'd fall asleep then. And then by the time I woke up, it was dark already. So yeah. I'd go to sleep and it was dark. Then the whole day would pass and I'd wake up when it was dark. There was this, I think it was a 2-week period where I did not see the sun because of my work schedule.
Yeah. It's like, And that's how, one summer of that, I'm like, I got to figure out a better plan because I'm not counting on music to like pay my rent, you know? And I just happened to get lucky enough, you know, actually I was still flight instructing a number of years into Zeparella. You know, that was still how it was until I got so busy touring and stuff that I was like, okay, I better shelve this. I mean, I still renew my flight instructor's licenses every 2 years. In fact, I got to do it next month. If I could offer you a little bit of maybe consolation about
your fire.
Well, first of all, I too do not like being super close to people. Like I'm a little not pathologically claustrophobic, but let's just say like I got enough of that I really don't like, you know, middle seats unless I know people on both sides. Like I definitely can get a little like and being really close to people who sometimes are just so inconsiderate is just a bummer. So that's the reality, unfortunately. In terms of any concerns or cautions you have, now I'm sure you're well acquainted with the statistics that tell you just how safe you are.
Yes.
Is it the bumps that bother you, the turbulence, or what?
You know, like, I have been trying to figure this out. So besides for the claustrophobia, having people close to me that I don't know, which I can't even stand, like being in an elevator with people I don't know and they're close to me.
Yeah.
I think there's a real thing of the loss of control, you know, that idea where I don't have control over my life and someone else has control. And I hate heights. I hate heights. But what consoles me when I am on an airplane on those rare times is getting the window seat so I can look out and pretend I'm not in an airplane.
Yeah.
Does it make any sense? I don't know.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, it's why people are much more afraid of flying than they are of smoking, right? You know, there's that sense of like agency. And yet the statistics will tell you like, dude, you should be much more concerned about a lot of other habits that we do, right? What I always tell people if they have concerns about, you know, pilots, you know, ineptitude or like, you know, mechanics or whatever. It's like at the end of the day, the amount of training you have to go through as a pilot is astounding. You have check rides every single step of the way. Like nobody gets fast tracked anywhere, you know, in aviation. Like when I showed up for my airline job, the reason I got hired into a jet right away, which was a nice plane to fly, was because I had really high multi-engine time. And that was because I had gone through and gotten all of my licenses that I could get at the age I was. I was too young to get my ATP, which is airline transport pilot. You had to be 23 for that. And I wasn't 23. So I got all my licenses. So I was one of the few people at the flight club who could teach multi-engine instrument students. So I ended up being the instructor who got all the students who needed to fly that way. So I had high multi-engine time, and yet once you're there, you're just on this assembly line. Like, you know, you don't get, you can be punished for messing up, but it's like, no matter how good of a job you do, it's all seniority based. And so I have great faith in the, let's just say the desire of the industry to make sure people really are up for the task, because I went through it. I mean, I saw what, you know, they do. I mean, like, I even remember at my job interview, like they tried to do like good cop, bad cop, and tried to like, be like, let me see your transcript. And I was like, oh my God, like, you know, you guys just assume I'm going to like sit here and cry at you because, you know, so, I'm very confident about pilots being far better vetted than a lot of other people who we put our faith into, you know, whether that's your Uber driver or your DoorDash guy or whatever. Let's just say there's a lot of faith we put into our systems in general. And I suppose you can go through life having no faith in systems, in which case, I really wonder if your life is actually much better. Sometimes we can be sometimes people or institutions break our trust. And at the same time, how much of our lives do we spend worrying about that trust being broken as opposed to just saying, hopefully I'll survive it, you know? And at least as it relates to airline safety, and maintenance is what I always tell people is imagine if your car, every single time you drove it, you yourself were trained in how to do a multi-point inspection of, let's say, about 50 items, right? And you were trained how to do that. Like you'd gone through a whole series of procedures for that. And you could do a lot of the little things yourself, right? Let's say before every time you drove, and that means if you drove from your house to the store, you did it. But also when you drive from the store back to your house, you do it, right? Every single time. Every single time that engine goes on before, you're doing a whole checklist of stuff. 50, maybe even 100 items if you talk about like pre-flight and taxi and takeoff and all of that. Let's just say a huge checklist. And then imagine that at regular intervals, your car is having anything that is slightly worn replaced immediately. And that's happening at regular scheduled intervals. And then on top of that, every year, it's going through a really, really serious like overhaul. And anytime after one of these like kind of more involved maintenance things, you're still, it's going out for a test drive to make sure, you know, that everything's okay. What are the chances that if you hit some bumps in the road, that the doors are going to fall off, right? It's like, well, they're never zero, but probably not something you're too worried about. So that's why I tell people like about, you know, airplane stuff. Plus, not just that, but like the level to which it gets blasted everywhere, anytime something happens, not to say things can't be better. You know, I don't work at Boeing. I don't know, you know, all of the ins and outs of like what people actually on the ground with their hands in it are, but I just know that boy, oh boy, the second there was that issue with the doors on the 737-900 MAX or whatever, those planes were grounded. People changed their flights. Like airlines would like let you, like they changed like, you know, which planes were flying and stuff like that. So it's a big enough concern for enough people that it ends up hitting companies where it hurts in the wallet. And so, you know, they try to keep things together. So I don't know if that's any consolation or, you know, my final thought on that, even for myself, because I tend to have like a lot of like dreams about this too, is I just thought, well, maybe this is a little dark, but still, we're all going to die somehow. I would much rather, it's way cooler to die in a plane crash than to die of dementia when you're like incontinent and like 1,000 years old. So I don't want to die in a plane crash, but there's worse ways. So
I just have to say, I love the way your brain thinks. So thank you. Thank you so much. Ask you, I have a couple questions that I'm so waiting for the answers, but did you grow up in a religious household? How did your parents navigate that? And for you, has it evolved over time, your relationship, if you have one, for, you know, what we can't define, what we can't see, that's larger than us?
So I did not grow up in a religious household. My mom, midway through my childhood, decided to take my sister and me to like a church. She had like good memories of going to church when she was a kid, but it was more like social stuff and the music and everything. So, and I just like, I didn't want to go. Like I wanted to like hang out with my friends and stuff like that. So I went with great resentment, with no pleasure. I did not enjoy anything about it. It wasn't even like cool looking. I was like, maybe if it would have been better if she had like tried to have me be like Catholic or something, or at least I was in some like really gorgeous Gothic cathedral or something, but you know, it was, you know, nice people and everything. So that was not for me. In hindsight, my mom says that she did it in part, not because she herself is religious, but more just to be like, she wanted it to be like our inoculation for cult mentality. She's like, if you have no, so she's a psychologist and she's like, you know, if you have no religion whatsoever, you can fall prey to like somebody selling it to you later in life. So I was not never religious. I was always a very skeptical kid. Like, I don't think I ever believed in Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy. Like, I just can't ever remember believing in that. And so for me, the idea of like God as described by, you know, any religion that I was ever affiliated with didn't resonate with me. And yet, I think it's almost impossible to go through life without sometimes being just like dumbstruck by the magic of our own existence, of consciousness, of the idea of like, okay, even if I was going to look at it from the most like coldly scientific viewpoint, what in the world is happening? The universe evolved stars and black holes and, you know, crazy gorgeous nebula. And then these little weird semi-hairless creatures on this little planet to have some degree of self-awareness, or like Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think, is the one who says that like we're the universe experiencing itself. Like, how just mind-boggling that is. So I don't know if that is described in any particular religion that I've, you know, participated in or witnessed. I have some friends who are very devout. I have a friend who's a very devout Baha'i, and my sister converted to Judaism. And, you know, so I always am interested in the role of religion, the history of religion, but organized religion has never been a thing for me. Although I'm definitely very interested in, you know, the big questions of like, how are we here? Why are we here? You know, all of, I think everybody's interested in that, right? However they describe it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. That's such a great answer. Thank you so much. Well, you know, I asked Clem this question.
Okay.
And it was essentially, what is one of your favorite memories of being on tour?
God, there's so many good ones. One that pops to my head was I was asked to do, it's not really on tour, but it was at a show. I was asked to come and play in Switzerland for some guitar festival. And it was funny because at the time my boyfriend who's from Italy, he was visiting and he was here for like 3 months, and I got asked to like kind of fly to Switzerland like the next week for like 48 hours. And they wanted me to participate in some guitar festival. And I was going to be the last act in, it was Locarno, which is in like sort of the Italian-ish part of Switzerland. And so I show up there, you know, having flown, you know, that long flight, you know, not in business class or anything. So sitting up in your little tiny economy seat, trying to get any sleep you can because you got to perform. And the whole time I was like, what is this? Like, why do they want me here or whatever? And I knew that I was going on after like a really big act. So I was like, oh, I'm going to be the music that like, you know, that they turn on, the house music they turn on to empty out the bar. I'm like, that'll be me. And much to my surprise, this whole like square of people, it was so many people. I mean, for me, it was so many people. And I'm there with this house band they hired for me. The bass player knew my husband. A lot of people knew my husband because they were Italian musicians. They wanted me to play Led Zeppelin songs. So I play Led Zeppelin songs without, you know, my girls, which was nuts and weird. And, you know, I made sure I got everybody's blessing, you know. And it blew my mind. Everybody stayed. Like, I really thought the main guy was going to be done and then, you know, and everybody would leave. But they stayed. They were the kindest audience. I really say it felt like I was Cinderella at the ball. Like, I'm like, I don't know how I got here. I don't know why these people know me, you know, but everybody was so kind. It was this kind of surreal, really beautiful experience that to this day, I'm like, I still can't explain it. I don't know how anybody knew who I was, but they treated me so well. And I had the best time, and it happened so quick. Cause you know, it was 48 hours. I was so jet lagged the whole time that it has this kind of fuzzy jet lag dreamlike quality about it, but it was really beautiful.
Oh my gosh. Please tell me it's on YouTube somewhere.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I learned early on, I don't Google myself. There's no, you get immediate karma for that kind of vanity. So I don't Google myself.
I never thought of that before, but I guess you're right. I mean, yeah, probably not a good idea. I'm sorry. Oh my goodness. No,
it was my own fault. It was like really early on. I'm like, oh, let me just Google myself. And then you end up in a chat room of people just like, you know, chatting about you like you're not there. And you're like, oh, I didn't need to see any of this.
Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Everybody has their opinions, I do have to say. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm a massive, massive fan of Led Zeppelin. And when I was just out of college, I went to go see Page and Plant in Chicago. And one of the funniest things that's ever happened, because I am not a headbanger, okay, but I'd had a few drinks and my friend was holding a beer. She was drinking it and she was holding it out to the side and we were headbanging and I got a little too excitable and I headbanged the middle of my forehead into the top of her beer bottle, which shot out of her hand and shattered on the ground.
Oh God.
Day, I had this perfectly circular round bruise on my forehead. I am going to remember this forever. She was not happy that I had like destroyed her beer. And you know, when you reach a certain level of inebriation, can't really feel things as much. And so it was really the next day where I was like, oh my God, what happened? Look at my forehead. I remember what happened, but what? Anyway. Yeah. So, oh my God, you know,
it's painful.
Yes. Loved the music. It was like perfect that it happened during a Page and Plant concert. I was this is perfect. Ask you, when your father was taking you to the store and, you know, piling these CDs and saying, oh, yeah, you need to listen to this person, and this person, yeah, was he, I mean, did any of that music speak to you as to what you'd be working on and playing later on in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in that first stack of, I think it was about 15 CDs, was Django Reinhardt and Stephen Grappelli with the Quintet of the Hot Club of France. Remains one of my favorite albums. Like, truly, that would be a desert island album for me. I love it so much. And so people are sometimes really surprised when they're like, wait, you've listened to Django like as long as Led Zeppelin? I'm like, well, neither are from like neither were the popular music when I was growing up. So either way, if you get into music, you're getting into, you have all of the past as your possible catalog. It doesn't matter if like grunge is the thing. The point is like you have everything up to that, right? And so Django spoke to me like immediately. And I think part of it was that like the music sounded like old and cool. What I had a harder time with, which I got into later, was Jeff Beck, who everybody, all my heroes love Jeff Beck. Everybody talked about Jeff Beck. My dad was like, you have to get this one, you have to get this one. But the albums just had that like, they just sounded really 70s and not in a way that like, you know, my ears were happy. They just sounded like old and cheesy. They sounded like something, you know, that I didn't like, I don't know, music production had gotten so good by the time I was getting into music that some of those older albums just didn't, unless it sounded cool and old, like scratchy record player, then it was like, I don't know. So I didn't get into Jeff Beck until I saw him live. And then I was like building a shrine practically, you know, I fully joined the cult of Jeff Beck. and yeah, some of those, actually a lot of those, you know, albums in that stack are albums that, you know, to this day I think are fantastic. So Steve Moore's like Southern Steel and High Tension Wires, all of his albums, Steve Moore's band, are fantastic. Eric Johnson's, you know, has some incredibly fantastic, you know, tracks too. Steve Vai, Joe Satriani, you know, kind of like the stuff you got to listen to if you're becoming a guitar nerd.
Yeah, I want to go back to the fact that your mother was so prescient and brilliant with the fact that she wanted to inoculate you against joining a cult later on in your life, yeah. Yet you eventually did anyway, with because you just used that language, I joined the cult, and I just thought, oh, how funny. It was just a different kind of cult.
It was.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, and, you know, I think it's more that Jeff Beck is revered amongst guitar players for a really good reason, but I felt like for me, I had to get to the point in my music development where you can hear past his influence on other people and recognize him as, I don't want to say it, none of us are born in a vacuum, right? So like we're all influenced by things around us, but whether it's Jeff Beck or Eddie Van Halen, it took me a while to appreciate both of those guys because their influence was so widespread that I remember hearing it. I'm like, why is this different from like a lot of other guitar players? And it took me getting to the point in my own musical development to be able to like actually perceive like, oh, everybody else is trying to like imitate this, or, you know, to understand why people who were better than me like thought he was, you know, superhuman.
I love that. Thank you. Well, I'd love to ask you the main question of the podcast, which is, I would love to hear a story or stories, if you feel like you want to share more than one, of an event where you've either witnessed or experienced it yourself, something that was beyond words, something magical, miraculous, or mysterious, whatever you'd like to share.
Okay, so as soon as you said that, I was trying to think of like, which one should I share? Because I feel like I have... three came to my mind. I don't want to overburden you with, should I pick one or would you like to hear?
I'm here for all of them. If you have the time, it's up to you.
I have the time and none of them require a huge amount of time.
Okay.
I'll start with the first one. That's the most tangible. I can't attribute anything larger to it, but I was about 16 years old. And again, I was a very lucid, like, I don't want to say grounded. Let's just say I was, you know, I still feel that I'm the same person as I was when I was like that age. I just remember feeling, you know, just aware and grounded. It was the middle of the day. It was just like I was going to walk downtown with one of my good friends, and I ran upstairs to grab my shoes and we were going to walk downtown. And I hear this like dragging noise. Let me see if I can like, it is this kind of noise. And I look over, and on my desk, the padlock that I kept for my gym locker, I saw it move across the desk, just, and then it tossed itself like halfway across the room. It wasn't violent, but it was so weird. And it was like, you know, every time you see something like in a movie, when somebody sees something kind of unfathomable and they act like an idiot, that was how I was. Like, I looked around, I was like, was there an earthquake? You know, I'm looking around to see if anything else is shaking. Not that an earthquake makes a padlock just throw itself across the room. That wasn't, and I looked to see if my windows were open, as though a breeze could have done that. And I even went over and I picked up the padlock again, like an idiot in a movie, and was like, huh? And I just kind of looked around. I was like, so that happened. I can't explain it. I'm always the show me the science person. I'm like, well, that was very odd. And then along similar lines, this is a thing that my mom gave me. It's this old like thing where like when they used to have like coils of stamps and it would come out here. It's where I keep my guitar picks, right? And I've had this for years. And when I was in college, I just had it on my desk because I had my picks. And I'm sitting there at my desk, and this just goes clink, like that. Just pops off. And you can see there's nothing there. This isn't airtight. This is like a slit. And it happened more than once. And so I'm like, okay, I don't know what's going on, but like those are a few things that I've seen that give me enough pause in all of my like scientific rigor to say, I've seen some things that I don't understand why it happened. I don't know what happened. I'm not going to draw any conclusions, but I can just say that was really weird. I don't know what that was. I can't explain it. So that's my mundane one. And then my kind of oddly beautiful one is that I was at a party when I was about 22. I was young enough that I hadn't been that many places in life. I'd been to high school and college and that was it. And it was up in Tahoe and there was a girl there and I just knew, like, immediately I just kind of liked her. She just seemed cool. And we were talking and I kept trying to place her. I'm like, I think I know this girl. How do I know this girl? How do I know this girl? Because there wasn't a clear way we'd know each other. And midway through the conversation, she's like, dude, I'm sorry if I'm tripping out, but like, I swear I know you. And I'm like, okay, right? I feel like I know you too. And then we kept talking and she's like, it's so strange. I feel like we're friends. She's like, I know what your laugh sounds like. It's so weird. And so we stood there for like about an hour, kind of tracing out our entire existence. Like, where did you spend Christmases as a kid? Did you ever travel this place? Kind of exhausted everything. Cause at the age of like 22 or whatever, it's like, you haven't been, even if you've done some traveling, there's not that much, you know, there's not that many places you could have met somebody if it wasn't in school or whatever. And I remember her just kind of shrugging and saying like, maybe it was a past life. And it was the first time I was ever like, God, what an interestingly weird thought. Like, whatever it was, this immediate sense of deep, like, kindred, like, friendship with a stranger that was a mutual feeling was very, I don't know, interesting, cool, like, you know, that was really, really cool.
Did it sort of feel like coming home? You know, it was like, yeah. You're like, oh, there you are.
Yeah. It was like recognizing, it was like, I don't think I've seen you someplace. And yet you're so familiar to me that I feel like I must know you. I feel like it must be like, you know, when you talk about, like, when people talk about having like amnesia or like a head injury and like they recognize that the person in front of them is somebody they love, but they can't tell if it's their mom or their child or their wife or whatever. It was like that. It was like this person that I'm like, I know, I feel like I know you and I feel like I adore you, but how do we know each other? And why are you feeling the same way too? You know, and it wasn't just like we were vibing off each other. It was like, it was something weird. And I remember, like, you know, after that, I would see her in town and run into her in the store and stuff. And she was great, but it was always so strange to have this feeling of like, why do we know each other? It was very surreal. And then I guess maybe the last thing that I would be worth sharing, only because it's actually proven to be helpful to me. So if it might help anybody else, it's worth sharing, right? So I was going through a really hard time when I was a teenager, like every other teenager, and I was feeling very deeply existential and alone in the world and everything. And it was a time where I was like, I was spending a summer abroad in France, which sounds like really exciting, and it was, and I'm glad I did it, but it wasn't easy. You know what I mean? It's like, I have a really wonderful family. I really missed them. It was sort of my first time feeling, it wasn't like I was alone, but feeling alone. Right. And I remember I'd go for these really, really long walks and having this moment of feeling like just, like that I just didn't want to be miserable. Like, but I was having such a hard time not being miserable and thinking about myself in the past of times where I was like a kid and had been upset or somebody had been unkind to me or something. And thinking about how we have a tendency to look back on ourselves with kind of this like gentle compassion of like a benevolent older sibling, you know, to think back at like the terrible haircut you had in fifth grade or, you know, whatever. There's this like this gentleness that we can extend to ourselves in the past that we have a hard time doing for ourselves in the present. And in that moment, I realized that the future me was going to be extending that kind of benevolence to the me that was suffering. And I remember kind of really like that helped me a lot in one moment. And I remember kind of taking that moment and saying to myself, like, essentially, okay, Gretchen of the future, remember to come back to this moment and give me the strength that you'll have in that time. And so sometimes if I'm feeling that kind of just like terrible, like just desperation and need of some sort of solace, I'll make that promise to myself. And then in the future, when I feel better, when I feel proud of myself for having persevered in some, you know, in a moment that was really difficult, you know, whether it proved to be a good moment of triumph or a challenging moment of, you know, humiliation or whatever. The point is that if you can kind of make the promise to yourself to come back to that moment with compassion and kindness, it's really comforting in the moment. And that had this sense, maybe magic's the wrong term, but that sense of larger connectedness, like connectedness with like a part of yourself that's like your essence that you know you can call back, you know, at different times.
Okay, that's ridiculously gorgeous. I just want to make a couple points. Okay, first, I just love how you reference your first story about the padlock moving on its own, that little canister, the lid flipping off on its own as quote unquote mundane. Because if those things would have happened to me, I would have been like, mundane is the last word. I would have been like, hello, everybody. Come, did everybody see this? Let's form a new religion to worship whatever's happening here.
The little pick holder. Like,
yes. I mean, so that was so funny and charming. I was like, I just love it. And how powerful to just have that moment where you're feeling so alone and you give yourself grace, right? So it's almost like you traveled into the future to give your present self grace in that moment, because we can be so hard on ourselves, so hard on ourselves. And sometimes we can go whole days, weeks, months without being kind to ourselves.
Yeah.
But what you're really talking about is this moment, this kind of revelation at that time where you could, ooh, I see Ferdinand. Okay. Okay.
You show how beautiful you are.
Look at how beautiful he is. Okay, everybody. Ferdinand is gorgeous. I'm just putting that in.
He's a handsome boy.
And I love it when cats just wake up from a nap because they're so
messy.
Yes, and they're smooshy. They're kind of smooshy and you want to smoosh them.
Yeah.
But it's like almost you gave yourself a benediction, one that you needed in the moment, and that changed everything. And it's simple and we can do it every day. So yes, I thank you. It's simple and powerful. So thank you.
Oh, well, I like I said, it's been bizarrely helpful to me. And what I always tell people when I tell them about this, like little thing that my brain does or whatever, or that I, you know, this interaction between my current self, past self, and future self, is the one thing I always say is, but here's the deal. You can't leave yourself hanging. So if you in a moment reach out to your future self, that becomes like a flag in your personal, like I can tell you every time I've done that, because I don't just do it every day. I do it in those moments where I'm like inconsolable. I am existentially alone. And the point is, because you got to keep a record of those, because you got to go back, not just tomorrow, not just in a week, but those become your little moments where you're like, I got you. I got you. I got you, you know? And otherwise you cheapen your own, as you called it beautifully, you know, your own sort of benediction. You know, you want that to be something that you call upon when you really need it, and you go back and you give it with total commitment.
Okay. If you form a cult, can I join?
Oh my God. I'd be such a lazy cult leader.
That's amazing. Have everyone else do the heavy lifting. You can just be present. I love that. We will not tell your mother. It'll be a secret.
Oh my God. She's I learned later in life that my very, you know, sweet, you know, caring, disciplined mom who's like, we're going to enrich you here and you're going to do this and all that, is totally sick and twisted, which is wonderful. I always thought that I got my sick and twisted sense of humor from my dad, who's like, you know, a total jokester and stuff. But my mom's got a sick side that I'm like, oh, I think that's where, I think that's actually where I get some of the darker parts of my humor.
Hey everybody, did you fall in love with Gretchen just like I did? I mean, there will be a link in the episode show notes to her website, to some of her YouTube videos, and to some other delicious goodies that I think you should check out. I mean, it would really behoove you to take a look at some of those videos because honestly, her talent is just ridiculous. And what I especially appreciated about, you know, her talking about learning guitar, etc., etc., was she felt like she had to start from somewhere. You know, as a kid she did, but even later on, there were new things to learn and she was nervous, but she went forward. She faced them. She said, I'm not gonna say no. I'm gonna walk towards this, even though it challenges me, even though I might suck at it, even though it's scary, I'm gonna do it. So those are the kinds of people that I think we should watch. Those are the kinds of people we should model ourselves after. And those are the kinds of people that are changing this world into a more gorgeous place. Now, I need to thank Gretchen for taking the time and giving me a few hours of her life so that we could laugh and swoon over her cat Ferdinand, because we did do a little of that. And, you know, she was just really present and really funny during the interview. For those of you who like what you hear, please do know that I have a back catalog of so many episodes, and each and every human being tells a story that is profoundly gorgeous, and it just might change the way you view the world. For those of you who like what you hear as well, I'm always looking for ratings and reviews, so if you find it interesting, if you like what you hear, go to the platform of your choice and give me a rating or write a little review. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Gretchen. I mean, her entire life, it appears, she faces towards what makes her nervous. She faces towards what scares her, and she walks towards it. I know there have been plenty of times where I have second-guessed myself and thought to myself, I don't know if I have the chops to do that. I don't know if I have the capacity to do that. And recently, I was talking to a friend who said, you know, I'm looking for a publisher. It's so frustrating. It's so hard to get published. They said, you're so lucky that you put so much out into the world. And I said, look, I'm not going to wait around for someone else to give me permission. I'm not going to wait for someone else to say, hey, now it's your turn. I mean, I'm going to make it my turn 24/7. And yes, it's scary to put my books out. And yes, it's scary to put this podcast out. It is terrifying to put ourselves out in the world, because people, as Gretchen said, if you Google yourself, sometimes people are not nice. All I can do is encourage each and every one of you that has a dream in your heart, that wishes for something different, or that has some sort of product they want to put into the world, go do it. Be like Gretchen. And even though it scares you, and even though it might, you know, you might question your abilities, just know that the world is waiting for you, and it's waiting for the beauty that you're going to bring. I'll see you in a few days for the next episode. And until then, I hope these days are filled with summer joy, lots of gorgeous sun, but with using sunscreen, and laughter that lasts as the day is long.